Welcome to a podcast of An Ebook Update, presented by Stephen E. Gillen, a partner at Wood, Heron, and Evans, where he concentrates his practice on publishing, media, and copyright matters. Gillen also teaches electronic media law at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. This podcast was recorded at the 2012 Text and Academic Authors Association Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. TAA is the only nonprofit membership association dedicated solely to assisting textbook and academic authors to enhance the quality of textbooks and other academic materials by providing them with educational and networking opportunities. For more information about TAA, visit www.taaonline.net.
My name is Steve Gillen. I'm an attorney in Cincinnati, Ohio. I work at a law firm called Wood, Heron, and Evans. It's an intellectual property boutique with about 50 lawyers that do nothing but intellectual property work. And by that, I mean patent law, trademark law, copyrights. I'm the copyright guy, trade secrets, advertising, media, entertainment, licensing, privacy, those sorts of topics. We don't do we do litigation and transactional work and provide advice to our clients. The firm has been around for a little over 140 years. It was founded in 1968. I have not been there that entire time. I'm also a council member, have been a council member for a number of years at TAA, and am pleased to have a continuing opportunity to address you folks at these conferences. When I started to put together my thoughts about this subject and picked, an ebook update, it was probably 6 or 8 months ago, and I had plenty of time to think about it. And, as time has gone on and I've collected my thoughts on this subject, I've realized that there's a lot that we don't know about ebooks, and I don't know as much of it as anybody, right? But I did manage to pull together what I have learned about ebooks and organize it in some sort of fashion. And so what I'd like to talk about is, first of all, what is an ebook? That sounds like a simple question, but I think the answer is more complicated than you might suspect. What do we know about the business model? Because it's a different business model for ebooks than for trade books, and having some of that information as much as we can get will be useful in understanding the positions that the publishers sometimes take and the booksellers sometimes take. What about royalty rates? That's something that's important to you, and royalty rates can be different with respect to ebooks. You think that they should be more different than they are, and we'll talk about why that isn't necessarily the case. What are the contract issues? That's another topic that's probably close to your heart. What should you be looking for in your contract? What should you be watching out for? And then finally, what's happening in the courts? Because a lot has been happening in the courts. It's been very difficult for me to keep up with the cases that have been filed over the last few months and the things that have developed in connection with those cases. I'm happy to take questions at any time, right? So don't save your questions to the end. If I say something you don't understand or if I say something you disagree with, don't hesitate to call me out. So what is an ebook? Well, there isn't one answer to that question because an ebook is a lot of different things. It could be as simple as a PDF file. It could be a more sophisticated Kindle, or it could be a very sophisticated iBook application. It could be, as I say, PDF form. It could be EPUB. It could be the Mobi for Kindle. It could be an app for an iPhone system or an Android system. It could be an XML or DAISY or Adobe. It could be iBook Author, and this is relatively new. It's a new authoring tool made available by Apple. It was announced at the beginning of this year. The application is free to authors, but it comes with some strings attached. And so I say watch out for this one. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that because we've only got 40 minutes till happy hour. But there is a four-page article at the back of your handout that talks about some of the issues with the iBook author license. It could also be an integrated learning system. That's something that we're more likely to find, of course, in the educational market, less likely to find in a trade market. There are some almost 30 different formats, file formats, that that an ebook could take, and this is a collection of some of them, and they don't talk to each other. And so if you're a publisher doing an ebook, you can't just pick, it's not one conversion, it's a lot of conversions, and you have to make some choices and decide how you're going to invest your money. I did a little looking, just anecdotally, at the information that's out there with folks who are publishing their books in ebook formats, and where are those books selling? And about 65% of the books are selling on the Amazon Kindle platform. About 20% on the Barnes & Noble Nook, about 14% on the Apple, and 1% on all of those others that you saw up there. But, of course, these numbers are heavily influenced by what's happening in the trade. That's what we have the most information about, and it's not certainly not representative of what's happening in education. It's also the case that that these numbers are based on our early experience in books in general, and the growth that we've experienced most recently, which is also developed as a consequence of the rapid acceptance, market acceptance of the Kindle platform. But we have a 2012 book industry study group study that reports that the market is moving away from dedicated e-readers toward tablet devices. So the dominance that we've seen with the Kindle device may not be with us forever. The net result of all of these different devices that don't talk to one another, all the different file formats, is that it's more complicated actually to make an e-book than it is to make a video, because one format isn't going to work on all of these devices. So what do we know about the business model? Well, this is, I know that you can see it, it's 50 Shades of Grey. It's a very popular trade book these days. And what we know about the business model is that the trade business model is not like the textbook business model. So I did a look at how many publishers we have, for instance, and the top line is publishers in general in the U.S. I took a count between 1990 and a count then again in 20 years later in 2010, and we had just under 10,000 U.S. publishers in 1990 and just about 36,000 U.S. publishers in 2010. Well, that's a tremendous growth from under 10,000 to over 30,000. In a 20-year period, and what accounts for most of that is the change in publishing technology, the development and advancement of desktop publishing, the access to print-on-demand services, the access to the marketplace for individual authors and small publishers through Amazon's program and Google's program and those sorts of things. And so you don't have to be involved in trade publishing. You don't have to have a big capital budget. You don't have to have access to printing presses. You don't have to print, make a commitment to an initial printing of 10,000 units. You can do this on a pretty small investment, and so we have a proliferation of publishers over the last 20 years. But the converse is true in textbook publishing. We don't have the same sort of forces at work, because in textbook publishing, there's a high cost of entry, and that hasn't gotten better. I think it's probably gotten worse, and so looking at literary marketplace as a resource, in 1990, we had about 800 independent textbook publishers, and by 2010, that number was reduced almost in half. And so publishers like SRA and Steck Von and Merrill and others that you heard about years ago, Irwin, you know, we don't hear about those anymore. They either don't exist or they've been assimilated into other publishers. So trade books are not textbooks. In 2008, there were 500,000 books registered for ISBN numbers. In 2010, there were 3 million. So that's a 6 times higher number 2 years later. Of that 3 million in 2010, about 315,000 of those were traditional titles, and they're growing at a rate of about 5% a year. But the other 2.8 million were non-traditional titles. So those are those desktop published, the e-books, and all of that. And in the 315,000, that's where the textbooks were. They were a fraction of that number. The total market in terms of dollars is about $30 billion a year, and the textbook share of that is a third, about $10 billion a year. ebooks. You hear that ebooks, the sales of ebooks are taking off tremendously. This is a chart that shows that sales trend. And what you can see is that in the third quarter of 2010, year on year, the rate of growth was over 100%. Looking at more recent numbers, I think the compound annual growth rate for ebooks is in the neighborhood of 100%, approaching 100%. And but it's starting from a very small base. So ebook sales are projected to grow at a worldwide rate of 30% across the world from 2010 to 2015. And at this rate, they're going to double every 2.4 years, but again, from a very small base. I think that the number that I see a lot is that ebooks represent less than 5% of the total market, and I think it's significantly less than 5% if we look at just textbook publishing. Most of this growth, as I say, is text-only trade books. Still, not more than 5% of the total market is ebooks, and as I say, much less than textbooks. Unlike trade publishing, in textbooks, there hasn't been the same level of market acceptance of one or a couple common platforms. The approach is more sophisticated in a lot of cases, and in a lot of cases that we're looking more at integrated learning systems than at a simple platform. And we don't have the kind of penetration that they've had in trade because we don't have the same kind of market acceptance of one or just a couple of platforms. CourseSmart, founded in 2007 by a combination of Pearson, Cengage, McGraw-Hill, Wiley, and Macmillan, so they get together to form a company that is going to help get their books to market in electronic form. This is a system that's interoperable through any learning management system, at least that's what they say, and any device with internet connectivity and a browser. It now distributes for more than 30 other publishers and claims to offer 90% of the established core textbooks. Now, you know, I don't know how they count those numbers. Those are the claims that they make. But this is the publishers finally getting together to form a company that's going to establish a platform that has a broader market acceptance, broader reach. But we also know that colleges are concentrating their buying power in response. And so in 2010, Cal State, in partnership with Cengage, CourseSmart, and Follett, began offering a digital textbook rental program to its students, advertising 60% off the printed book price. So the college is recognizing that they're going to have to deal with concentrated power from the vendor side, have decided they need to get together and use their combined power to negotiate from the buying side. And they claim to have saved students $62 million so far and expect that to increase this year to $118 million with 5,000 students participating. Indiana University has a program that started in 2010, and now they have 50 participating institutions. In 2012, five colleges, Cornell, UC Berkeley, University of Minnesota, UVA, and University of Wisconsin, got together with Internet2 to pool their ebook buying power. All of this activity is driving prices down, of course. There's a price competition involved here. But at least in theory, the volume is coming up since an ebook isn't resold in the same way that a printed textbook. Yes, Mike? I will try. I think it's a license. You know, I think that's a fancy word for a license. See, all ebooks are licensed. They're not sold, at least in educational publishing. They're typically licensed for a time. In contrast to the model in trade where you get an indefinite license when you buy a book for your Kindle. Yeah, Mike? I have not. I'm very curious to see it. Yeah, I'm gonna talk about that. Okay. But I think that's an excellent point. Then there's Chegg, a book rental business, started in the print book rental business in 2005, went national in 2007. They buy books either wholesale or from the publisher or in the marketplace. They expect to turn each copy that they buy 3 to 4 times. Again, that puts some downward pressure on your revenues, because instead of making 3 or 4 sales, you're going to make 1 sale. The publishers realize revenue only on the initial sale, unless they're in partnership with Chegg, and Chegg claims to have saved students $210 million in the first 3 years of operation. But remember, that's against a $10 million annual textbook business, so less than 1%. It sounds like they're having a big impact, but the savings that they're claiming should be imperceptible in your royalty statements. The expense components, well, let's look at the costs that go into making a book and how we can categorize them. There's cost of goods sold, which is, for a print book, is paper printing and binding. And there's fulfillment costs, and then there's royalties. And those are costs that vary with the volume. So as you sell more books, those costs go up proportionately. On the other hand, there's development and prepress, which are recouped over the life of sales, and some overhead that is, at least in the short term, is fixed. And so from the margin that you end up with on the variable expenses, what's left from the revenue has to cover the fixed expenses before the publisher starts to make any money. Cost of goods sold and fulfillment are going to be less for ebooks, but they're not zero. Okay, everybody seems to think that once you get your ebook, it doesn't cost you anything to distribute it, but it does. And in some cases, if you're distributing through Apple, it's going to cost you 30% for that third-party distribution service. It costs, most of these come with some sort of digital rights management. The cost of that varies from just a few cents to maybe as much as a buck. Number sort of in the middle of the range is 50 cents, and then 3 to 7% for payment processing if you're making your sale over the Internet. So there are some costs here. They're not certainly equivalent to the cost, variable costs for print books, which can reach 30%, but the publisher is going to have to cover these fixed expenses with the remaining margin with fewer units at a lower price. So if they had only ebooks to cover their fixed expenses and an overhead with, they would have to sell a lot more units than the less than 5% that they're presently selling, or the margin would have to be a lot bigger. In fact, for every dollar that a print book contributes to cover the prepress and fixed costs, an ebook would have to contribute $20 if we were just dependent on the meager sales of ebooks. And so when you see an ebook that isn't priced at zero, which is what you think it ought to be because it doesn't cost them anything other than a few electrons, it's more complicated than that. What about royalty rates? Well, there's not much really that's new here. There's still a lot of uncertainty. Ebook rates in textbook publishing, when there is a specified ebook rate, and the textbook publishing contracts vary depending on how old your is and how old your contract is and who the publisher is, they tend to be the same as the domestic print rate. So if you are getting a 12% royalty or a 15% royalty on the domestic sale of your printed and bound books, that's probably the same royalty that's going to be applied to your ebooks. If your print royalty is on a sliding scale, the sliding scale may or may not apply to the ebooks. The ebook rates in trade tend to be 25% of net receipts. And so folks here in our community here, the trade authors are getting 25% and we're only getting 12 or 15%. Well, it's apples and oranges, really, because in the trade, the royalty rates tend to be lower, but they're calculated on cover price, not on net receipts. And so if you have a 12% royalty rate in a trade contract on cover price, that really is approaching the equivalent of a 25% rate on net receipts. Okay, and so what they're getting in trade publishing is essentially the same deal that's being offered in textbook publishing. They're getting effectively the same royalty rate, or something very close to the same royalty rate, on electronic editions as they are on print. So what are the contract issues? Okay, now that we know something about what the market looks like and something about what the business model looks like, the contract issues are, first of all, who has these rights? Are they left with the author, or have they been transferred to the publisher? Secondly, is it a license or a sale? That's the point that Michael was getting at and that we'll talk more about in a couple of minutes. How are the bundle proceeds allocated? I'll explain what that means in a few minutes. And And have you that should be captured. See, in the other room they were talking about how many times do you have to proofread before you catch all the mistakes? And the answer is not, you can't do it enough. Have you captured all of the revenue? And I'll explain what that means in a minute also. So who has the rights? Well, in trade publishing, the way that the contract language has historically read is that the publisher gets the exclusive right to publish the work in book form, okay? And the question was, if the contract was written in the early 70s or late 60s, what did that mean in book form? Was that in the book form that existed in that era, or was it broad enough to encompass e-books as they developed? And so we have a recent case, HarperCollins versus Open Road, where HarperCollins had a late 60s, early 70s vintage author contract that conveyed publishing rights in book form. Along comes Open Road, convinces the author that the author has e-book rights, that they were not conveyed to HarperCollins, and contracts with the author to publish an e-book edition of this very successful book from 1971, and promptly gets sued by HarperCollins, who says, no, no, no. Well, it happens that in 2001, a federal court interpreted substantially identical language from a 1967 Dell contract not to include book rights, and I don't have any reason to believe that the result is going to be different now. So I think that in book form, if that contract was written in 67, 70, 71, 72, it probably means just printed book and not e-book, but it's hard to make sweeping generalizations about things like this because the contracts vary so much from one to the next. If your contract is early 1970s or before and hasn't been amended since, it's possible that you have them. Now, it's not likely because this grant language that we see so often in trade books is not what we typically see in textbook publishing. In textbook publishing, the more common model is that the author actually conveys the entire copyright to the publisher. But not all textbook divisions. There are publishing companies that have both a textbook division and a trade division, oftentimes it's not the textbook division that's calling the shots. And so you can find a textbook contract written by a house that also has a trade side where the textbook, they've made a mistake effectively, and the textbook contract actually looks like a trade book contract. So the only way to know for sure is to look very carefully at the language in your contract to see what it says about what rights were conveyed. Is it a license or a sale? Well, the royalty rate on a sale is typically 10 to 15%. By sale, I mean the sale of a product that the publisher invested in manufacturing and distributing. Okay, and for many, many years, that represented the lion's share of the revenue that publishers enjoyed. They enjoyed from making and selling books. Okay. And so in that context, they had a lot of costs. We've talked about those. They had to cover those costs. And so the royalty rate that seemed to be fair and reasonable under those circumstances was in the 10 to 15% range. There was a secondary revenue stream in those days, and it was something that we call subsidiary rights. And in those cases, the publisher that had rights that it wasn't in a position to exploit itself, it might be a French translation, it might be an audiobook version of the book, it wasn't in a position, didn't have the equipment, didn't have the expertise to exploit that, wasn't going to invest any money in it, so it was going to license somebody else to do that. It would get a small payment in return, like a royalty payment, 10, 15%, maybe 20% in some cases, and because the publisher didn't have any costs associated with fulfilling that transfer, then what they would do typically is split that money 50-50 with the author. It's extra money over the transom. And so we have these two revenue streams, the one of which is burdened by a 15% royalty and the other of which is burdened by a 50% royalty. So it makes a very big difference whether a transaction is a single copy sale or a license. Okay, it makes at least a 35%, maybe a 40% difference in what the publisher is going to have to pay the author in the form of a royalty. So what we end up here in the e-book connection, e-books are not typically sold in the same way that printed books are sold. They're licensed, okay? You get a license to use an e-book. You get a license to distribute an e-book. And that's more like The publisher doesn't have a lot of costs in delivering that. That's more like the subsidiary rights transaction than it is like the single sale transaction. And so there's an argument that at least with respect to some of those sales, and it may be that the sales through CourseSmart are in that category, that that's a license rather than a sale, and whatever money, whatever revenue comes in from CourseSmart should be split 50-50 with the authors. I am pretty confident that that's not what they're doing. If you can figure out what they're doing when you look at your royalty statement. This is a contract interpretation question on both ends of the transaction at issue. So we're going to have to look at your contract with the publisher to figure out what it says and what it means with respect to this kind of transaction. But then we're going to have to look at, on the other end of that deal, at the publisher's contract with the ebook distributor to see how it's characterized there, because there are two different models that may take, and I'm going to talk about that. Any single case is not likely to have a broad impact. If one of these cases gets litigated, it's not going to likely to have a lot of meaning for other authors, because it's a contract question. Contract law is state by state. The rules are not the same from one state to the next. The contracts are not the same from one deal to the next. And even if the contract form is the same, if it's a close question, the interpretation may be different from one to the next. Yes.
Uh-huh. So they make the profit from CourseSmart. They also, CourseSmart deducts certain expenses before that money that's coming over is divided up from the public. So a lot of aspects of that whole thing that are very small.
Yeah, so I hear you saying that there are opportunities for sleight of hand, maybe.
Well, there's opportunities also for saying, look, you guys don't want this. Don't want to get to the bottom of it. We can look the other way, but for CourseSmart sales, we'd like to have a higher royalty.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So when we deal with a contract interpretation issue, we've got to look at the meaning of license versus sale. This could be either a question of fact or law, depending on the circumstance and the court and the state. We have to look for the presence or absence of an integration clause to know whether or not we can look to other documents. We have to consider the impact of an ambiguity, because in most of these cases, the language is going to be ambiguous because they weren't thinking about the possibility of ebooks and this sort of business model when they wrote those contracts. We have to look at the intent of the parties perhaps at the time. So, you know, looking backwards now, maybe 30 years, what was the intent of the parties in the late 60s or 70s? And we have to consider maybe the admissibility of what we call parole evidence in the law, which is evidence outside the four corners of the contract. So there are some generic rules of construction that we would take into account in reaching this conclusion. They're in very small type because there are a lot of them. And, you know, we have to decide whether the construction of the contract is going to be a matter of law for the court or a matter of fact for the jury. The primary task here is to ascertain and give effect to the intent of the parties. That's what we're charged with doing. A contract that's clear and unambiguous is going to be enforced as written, but, you know, almost by definition, these are not clear and unambiguous. We wouldn't be having this conversation. If the writing is clear, the court presumes that the party's intent resides in the words of the agreement. Well, that very seldom is applicable to these contracts. When a court is susceptible to two or more reasonable interpretations, this is important. Resolution of the ambiguity is for the trier of fact. And in fact, if there is an ambiguity that we can't resolve, it's going to get resolved against the party that drafted that ambiguity, most often the publisher. The court is going to not kick this to the jury if it can avoid it, if it can resolve the issue by employing some rules of construction, like giving terms their ordinary meaning unless they have a special meaning in the industry or trade, and looking to the surrounding law for guidance about how these terms should be interpreted and so on and so forth. And sometimes employing a theory called practical construction, where they look at how the parties acted after the contract was signed as some indication of what their intent probably was at the point in time when they signed the contract. So what I've done is I've culled the relevant language from some older to newer contracts just to give you a look at what we're talking about here. From a 1976 textbook contract, says the publisher shall pay to the author the following percentage of the publisher's net receipts on all copies sold. Copies and sold are the important words there. That's the 15% that we talked about. In this particular agreement, then, they talk about a second revenue stream, which they describe as licensed uses or uses of subsidiary rights by the publisher. In 1988 textbook contract, a publisher will pay the author a royalty on the amount received by the publisher for all copies of the work sold. So again, we have copies sold, not licensed, and the royalty rate is in the 15%. And then the 50% language from the revenue stream from right to license the exercise of any of the rights. Okay. In a 91 contract, again, we have sales by the publisher of copies of the work. So we have the word sales and we have copies. In this case, we've got a 5% because, not because I did a bad job negotiating this contract, but because there were several co-authors involved. And then the revenue stream from transferring, selling, or licensing to others the right to the publisher and the 50% rate on these license proceeds. So you see that even though the intent is the same across all of these three agreements across more than a decade of time, the language is it varies considerably from one to the next. So what probably is happening right now is that sales by the publisher or an unincorporated unit, business unit, direct to end user are likely to be at the domestic rate, and that's likely to be the case, even if it turns out to be an end user license to the end user rather than a sale. Sales through a licensee, like perhaps CourseSmart, may well be subject to this 50% subrights rate, depending on what their deal looks like. There are two basic formats these days for e-book distribution contracts. There's one that we refer to as the licensing or wholesale model, which has been employed by Amazon and Google, where the publisher sells, quote-unquote, e-books to the distributor. The e-book distributor buys a number of copies or authorization to distribute a number of copies, pays the price set for those by the publisher, and then decides on its own what its price in the retail market is going to be. Amazon was offering these books at $9.99. That, in many cases, was a price that was below what Amazon was having to pay the publisher to get the right to distribute the ebook. Why would they do that? Well, they would do that because they were building this big market share for their Kindle product. They wanted a lot of product. They wanted it to be low priced. They wanted to be controlling that market, and they've been pretty successful at that. The agency model comes along at the instance of Apple, and Apple says, you know, we should have a piece of this business, but we don't want to lose money on these sales just for the sake of market share. We want to make our typical 30% on these deals. And so what we will do is we'll adopt this new model called an agency model and maybe solve another problem along the way. And Apple said, you know, with the agency model, we will not buy these books from the publisher. We'll act as the publisher's agent for their resale. And we'll let the publisher control the price through to retail, and whatever it is what it is, and we'll take 30% of that. And so that became the agency model. Well, when they wrote those contracts, in the wholesale model, they use language that sounds a lot like licensing language. They are providing a grant of rights. They're granting a non-exclusive irrevocable right and license to do these things: reproduce, display, distribute, adapt, create derivative works, transmit. Those sound like copyright rights that are being licensed here. From the Google Books partner program, all content provided is referred to as authorized content, and Google may digitally scan so they can make a copy. They can store it on their servers, and in response to requests, they can deliver those. And so, again, that sounds a lot like licensing language in that contract between the distributor and the publisher. But the agency, along comes the agency model with Apple, and they say publisher hereby appoints the agent as its non-exclusive agent for marketing and delivery. So you don't see any licensing language in there. In furtherance of such appointment, the agent may market, solicit, and obtain orders on the publisher's behalf, make copies of, and otherwise prepare content files, but again, no license. They're paying an agency commission, not a royalty. The agent shall condition the use of the books on an end user's acknowledgement of terms and conditions. So not an end user license agreement, but terms and conditions. Parties agree that the nature of their relationship is that of publisher as principal and agent as agent, and the agent agrees to limits on its authority as agent. So a lot of language in here that is all sort of calculated to make it clear that this, or to make it appear that this is not a license, this is a different kind of deal. The end-user form is not an end-user license agreement. That's not what it's called. It's styled its terms and conditions, and it doesn't contain license language, but speaks in terms of limits on use and compliance with usage rules. And it also avoids the use of words sell or buy and talks instead of in terms of delivery of the product. So very careful all the way through all of this documentation to avoid any reference to license. I don't know whether this was for the purpose of avoiding that 50% the application of that 50% royalty, but that certainly is one potential impact. Well, of course, we have statute of limitations. These vary from state to state. It can be as short as 3 years and can be as long as 15 years. That gives you a window within which you can look back at your older royalty statements to figure, you know, should I have been paid under the 50% rate instead of the 15% rate? Okay, bundle allocations. When your book is delivered electronically, it's not delivered by itself electronically. It's delivered in combination with other bits and pieces that come from other places. Sometimes it's bits and pieces of another author's work that is also available for retail sale. Sometimes, however, that other stuff is stuff that the publisher has built and invested in. And so when it comes time to pay you your royalty on the sale, they are not going to pay you your royalty on all of the proceeds. They're going to allocate the proceeds across the units that are incorporated, the components that are incorporated in that package. And the allocation and method of allocation are usually opaque. They don't usually say, this is how we're doing it, this is what we did, and this is why we're doing it. And they may not be reasonable or fair. And about that, I will say no more. It depends on the language in your contract, and it depends on what they're doing. But it's not going to be easy, because first of all, it's not going to be easy to figure out what they are doing. Okay, another issue is to be sure that you don't leave revenue off the table. Not all of the revenue attributable to exploitation of your work electronically will always be either from licensing or sales. There are lots of ways of monetizing traffic on the internet. The publishers haven't really started to take significant advantage of that, but there are others that are entering the business that are starting to do that. And it's, I think, only a matter of time before the publishers figure out that there are other ways to commercialize, to exploit the traffic that gets generated as a consequence of the electronic product that they make available. So one day, some of this revenue may be from that traffic, and it would be best if your contract anticipated this, and I'm 99.9% sure that it does not right now. So what's happening in the courts? Well, we have Noh versus Cengage. We have the Google Books cases. We have a HathiTrust case. We have the Department of Justice antitrust suit against Apple and five of the six large publishers. We have a Georgia fair use case, and we have one other case that I'll talk about. The Noh versus Cengage case. Noh is a distributor of ebooks for at least four major textbook publishers, including Cengage. Cengage threatened to terminate Noh's distribution agreement early because Noh had developed applications in its service that allowed users to generate works that were derived to create derivative works from the textbooks that had been licensed through Noh. And so what the students were doing was enabled to do was to take a textbook and and using the Know application, create flashcards and study cards and things like that that were actually derivative works of the textbook, but the publisher wasn't getting any money for that, and they didn't like that. And so they sued Know in January for breach of contract. The case was quietly dismissed in mid-April, about 4 months later. We don't know why. That's my little joke, right? The Cengage contract would have expired in the fall anyway. You know, why Cengage would bother to terminate it, you know, when it was going to go away anyway? Why Know would sue to try to get it back in place, you know, because they're not going to get through this litigation before the contract would have expired anyway. But as of early this month, I know that Know still is listed as with 100%. I mean, more than 100 Cengage titles is available through Know. So they must have worked something out. Google Books cases, we've talked about those at these conferences. This is a dispute that's been going on for a number of years. In a nutshell, Google had arranged with five large libraries to scan the entire contents of their collections into a large database that was then going to be made available digitally. The owners of some of those books in those collections, you know, still had viable copyrights in those works and said, hey, you know, that's infringement and you shouldn't do that. Google said, well, we're Google and it's fair use. It's fair because we're doing it. And so there was a case in litigation for a number of years. It moved into settlement discussions that went on for a number of other years. They reached a settlement agreement on two occasions and on each occasion got sent back to their bench by the judge in the case who said, you know, I know that you think this is a good deal, but it's not fair to all the constituents. And so now we're back in litigation mode. The cases are presently before the court on standing issues and for summary judgment on the question of fair use. The standing issues have just recently been resolved in the favor of the authors. The authors have been granted class status, and the trade associations that were there on their behalf have been authorized to go forward as class representatives. And so at least that part of it signals that the court is favorably disposed to the side of the argument that we would advance, I think. Yeah, yes, unless there is some other maneuvering, and there may very well be. The HathiTrust case is a case that sort of spun out of the Google cases because of one of the things that the copyright owners were afraid of in the Google case. And one of the reasons that they sued Google was they said, hey, you know, we know that Google will be fair about this. We know they wouldn't do anything with this large database of copyrighted works that would be unfair to us. But one of the terms of the deal with the libraries was that Google was going to give each library access to a digital copy of their collection, which is not something the library could have made on its own. And the library said, you know, we're university libraries. We're not going to trespass on anybody's rights. Well, they formed the HathiTrust to trespass on people's rights by licensing access to this body of work, which is exactly what we were worried about. And, of course, the same folks who were involved in the Google case then have sued the universities and the trust to try to stop that. This case is pending. We have the Department of Justice, which was in discussions with Apple and a number of publishers, Penguin, Macmillan, Hachette, Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, not Random House. Random House opted not to participate in the Apple program that was the problem here. The concern of the Justice Department was it looked like it was a little bit suspicious that all of these publishers entered their deals with Apple within days of each other, that all of them had been having dinner meetings together before they entered those agreements all around the same time, that all of their agreements looked almost identical to one another. And so they said, maybe there's some collusion here, just maybe. And three of the publishers settled right away. Two of the publishers have decided to fight this case, Penguin and Macmillan. And Apple, of course, is up for a fight. And so this case is in litigation at this point. I think last I saw, Penguin had filed its answer in the case. Cambridge, Oxford University Press, and Sage sued the Georgia State University system for the university's use of an electronic reserve policy. The e-reserve policy said to professors, you can use our library to make digital copies of works in its collection that you want to make accessible to your students, and so they won't have to, you know, check out the physical book. They can get access to the e-version of the book, and these publishers said, you know, to the extent that that impacts our works, we think that that's copyright infringement. It's not a fair use. And the court considered this for a year. It turns out that what they were doing for a year is writing a 350-page opinion about this case, which I confess I have not read all of, but I have looked at it. And after looking at it, what I realized is that there were 99 works at issue in the suit. The publishers lost on 95 of them, so they won on 4 out of 99. And then they issue a press release touting their win. Happy hour. It must be happy hour. I knew this was going to be trouble. They issue a press release touting their win, okay? They lost 95% of this case, and they say, we're pleased that the district court ruling recognized that Georgia State University's flawed 2009 copyright policy resulted in infringement of our works, okay? That's the publisher's spin, right? So remember how they spin things when they tell you, this is my standard template publishing contract. You know, it's not negotiable. And now, this is, I didn't have this in my list because it just came to my attention, but Pearson Cengage and Bedford Freeman Worth have sued an internet startup company based in Boston called Boundless. And what Boundless is doing, they've raised $10 million in venture capital to build a business that is based on providing electronic alternatives to published adopted textbooks. So they will look at a particular textbook from Cengage, and they will go develop their own independent version of that textbook that covers the same subject matter and offer it for free to students as an alternative to buying the adopted text. So instead of buying the adopted text, you just go get something very like the adopted text for free. Now, why would they do that? Well, they're doing that to build a lot of traffic, and we'll figure out later how to monetize that traffic. But in the meantime, the publishers say, hey, you know, you got $10 million to do this. We have to take you seriously. We can't let you do this. It sounds like you're adapting or copying or deriving our books. And they say, no, you know, these are books about educational subjects, and the ideas are not covered by copyright, and we're not using your language. You know, but when they're selling to the students, and it's only in beta, so you can't really get access unless you get through their filter. But when they're selling to the students, what they say is, if you if your class has adopted this textbook, then what we have is an alternative, and it's free, and it is page for page the same as your textbook, right? And it correlates to this textbook, which they then name by name, okay? So it's not some generic book. It's a generic book that looks almost exactly like this other book. How they're going to defend that, I have absolutely no idea, but they have a $10 million war chest. So when the dust finally settles on ebooks, when all is said and done, there are just some things you can't do with an ebook. You can't prop up your sagging bed. You can't open a secret passageway with an ebook. You can't smash a spider with an ebook. And you can't hide a gun in an ebook. Okay? So they're not perfect substitutes. One of the things you can do, however, is get a personal digitally autographed copy of an ebook through a service called Autography. Okay, so if you buy an ebook, you can right away through Autography, and the author can digitally sign a electronic copy, which then is redelivered to you and situated on your Kindle. Okay, 10 minutes early, so you can thank me for that, but I'm happy to take questions. Although I don't promise any answers. Yes, Karen.
On the model that you talked about where the hard copy book is rented, there was some company it turns over.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that. Are there limitations on what the student can do with the book? Can you write in it, underline in it?
They can highlight in it. They're supposed to write in it. And they're asked not to over-highlight. I think a book that has some highlighting, they're what I hear is that that is actually more valuable than a book that hasn't been highlighted, because then the students don't have to read the whole thing. They only have to read the highlighted part. Okay, well, thank you all. You've been great.
An ebook update is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.